Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things testing and test automation related. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com and testtalks.com. If you're looking for information on BDD automation awesomeness, this is the episode for you, because we'll be speaking with Matt Nguyen, the author of the Cucumber book, Behavior-Driven Development for Testers and Developers. But first, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs, who makes all these episodes for Test Talks possible. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Sauce's cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up at saucelabs.com with promo code TESTTALKS14 and get 20 hours of automated testing for free. Before we get into the interview, I just want to give a special shout out to the two people that gave a 5-star review of Test Talks in iTunes. Jeff Filgar, I actually met him at HP's conference about 2 years ago. A really cool guy. Gave us a 5-star review in iTunes. And also Mario David gave a great review in iTunes. My first review from Germany, so that's really cool. So thank you, Mario, and thank you, Jeff, for those reviews. And also I received some emails from Amit Lernin with some really good feedback from my previous podcast. On, I was kind of worried about how I was interviewing people. And he just gave me some positive feedback that I really appreciate. So if you're involved in doing any type of behavior-driven development, I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. I had a really great conversation with Matt, and he really has a lot of insight into how BDD should be done, some best practices, and some really cool tips on Cucumber. Actually, this book, the Cucumber book, is my favorite book on behavior-driven development, and I don't even use Cucumber. So that should tell you how much I really like this book. So check it out. Hey, Matt, welcome to Test Talks.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
It's great to finally have you on the show. Today, I'd like to talk about Cucumber, BDD, and what I think is an awesome book, the Cucumber book. But before we get into it, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
I'm nearly 40 now. I've been developing software for a living for about 15 years, something like that. But obviously been programming for many years longer than that, actually. I was lucky enough to get a computer when I was a teenager, a kid, so I got into it really early on. My son's turning 5 this Christmas, and I think I may be going to give him his first computer for Christmas, actually. So it's quite an exciting time. But yeah, I found myself as a young computer programmer who also was reasonably good at speaking to people, as well as spending quite a bit of time with my computer. I'd also spent quite a bit of time, in the pub and socializing, and I'm reasonably good talking to people. And I sometimes found that I was quite unique on a software team, being able to both talk to the code and talk to other people. And I kind of recognized that very early on in my career, that there was a bottleneck there on software teams, that very often the people that wanted software and had the resources to pay for it, they had the problems that needed solving. And then the people that had the skills to solve them, those two groups of people just really didn't communicate very well at all. And I often found myself being that bridge, that translator on the team. And, it's an interesting role to be in, but it's also you see firsthand how many problems it causes when that communication doesn't happen, and people end up building the wrong thing and then having to kind of tear out bits of code that they've written that weren't really what was needed. And then, we're making a mess of the solution, and you never really manage to pull bad ideas out of code. It always ends up with scars in it. So that's how I got into all this stuff.
So it's kind of interesting then, if you being kind of a communicator, be able to speak to code and speak to an end user. Is that why you developed Cucumber? Was that the main reason you wanted to be able to bridge the gap between that you saw as you were developing on most projects?
Yeah, so I mean, I didn't develop Cucumber originally. It was developed by my friend and now business partner, Aslak Hellasoy. He's the person that created it in the first place. But the reason I got involved in the project so early on was precisely that. Yeah, I was drawn to, in fact, the first thing I heard about was this this thing called the RSpec Story Runner. So that was the very first implementation of Cucumber back in probably 2006, 2007. I saw a talk by Dan North and Joe Walnes about this this tool, which they've been developing at ThoughtWorks. And I was just really excited to find a community of people that cared about this same problem as I did. You know, I'd been doing Agile, I'd been doing TDD for a few years at that point. And Agile had been something that, you know, was already speaking to me as being in some way trying to bridge that gap and make that communication better, a more collaborative relationship between, you know, business people and developers. But specifically this thing about communicating about requirements, I was just really excited about the community around RSpec at the time, because it was just a group of people that really cared about this specific problem of, you know, how do we get developers and business people to understand each other better? So I was drawn to that community, and that just got me sucked into. So I was one of the very first users of Cucumber when Aslak created it, and used it on a project right from day one, really. So yeah, I became a really experienced user and got pulled into the project from that point of view. Yeah,
cool. So I guess I should have started off by asking, for the people that don't know, in a nutshell, you know, what is Cucumber?
Yeah, it's a good question. Because apparently what Cucumber is it's a tool for running acceptance tests. So if you don't know what an acceptance test is, it's a kind of automated test which you would write together with a non-technical person, a non-technical stakeholder on the team. If you're doing extreme programming, it might be the person you'd call the customer, the on-site customer. Or if you're doing Scrum, you might call them your product owner. It's the person who's the domain expert, the business expert, that understands what the behavior is that they want you to implement. And this is an old extreme programming, in fact, an old test-driven development technique, that the first test you write is an acceptance test. It's a customer-facing acceptance test. So you write that test together with the non-technical person. That describes how the story is going to behave once you've finished implementing it. You sit down together, you write that test, and then you go off and implement it. And, you know, maybe days later, you can show them that that test is now passing, and then they can actually play around with the behavior themselves as well. So it defines what the customer is going to consider acceptable. And Cucumber is a tool for running acceptance tests that are written in this particular style. So there are other tools like Fitness, which have done similar things in the past, where you can express the acceptance test in a wiki. And Cucumber gives you this format, which we call Gherkin. And it's very familiar to people, probably as a sort of given when then format for writing out each test case.
So basically you get a text file, which is called a feature file, where you write out your test cases, and you can then implement those with code to automate them at some point. So you have something called it's always called something different, but an executable specification is what some people call it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm a sort of an old school XP person. So acceptance test has always been a good enough name for me for these things.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I guess what the thing is that each one of those test cases that's in the feature file it's an example of good behavior of the system, right? If the system's in this situation and you do this to it, this is what you should expect to happen. Each one of those is an example of how you want it to behave. Each one of those, I would call it an acceptance test. Together, what you end up with is a specification of how the software behaves. And because it is executable, that becomes a benefit, because, you know, most documentation that's written about software is very difficult to keep up to date, because it's very difficult to test documentation, to test its validity, its continuing validity as the project moves. I know, you know, lots of projects I worked on in the olden days of software where we'd have a business analyst that was kind of scrabbling to keep up with us, writing the requirements document as we wrote the code, or even after, just so that they were making sure that there was some kind of documentation that described, you know, what had been built. So Cucumber can go a long way to solve that problem, both in terms of producing, you know, reference documentation after the the work's been done. But the interesting thing really that and the magic for me of Cucumber, of this way of working, is that because you sit down together with your customer and you can both work together on describing the behavior that you want, you have to have this conversation about what exactly you want. And that throws up all kinds of fascinating assumptions, misunderstandings, and gaps in both of your understanding of what exactly it is that you want. And you get the chance to thrash out a lot of that before you sit down and actually write code.
Awesome. So in my experience, I've seen people really pervert this. So I think, as you explained, it should be really at a high level a mechanism to help teams communicate with one another to know what they're developing before they actually even develop it. But what I've seen is people almost using it as an automation framework or just to store requirements and automate those requirements. So you being a core developer, is anything you see people using Cucumber in a way you think is not optimal?
Yeah, all the time, you know. I think the main problem is that most teams that think they're doing agile are really just doing Scrum. And they're not practicing test-driven development. So they may write some unit tests as they go, but they probably don't write them before they write the code. And they certainly don't write any acceptance tests. If they do write tests that sort of test the whole system integrated, they're usually written afterwards at the end of a sprint or even in the next sprint. And they're usually written by a separate group within the team. So, you know, a quality assurance person, a QA person, rather than being written as a developer activity. And it's really that approach to quality assurance that is broken from my perspective. So there's this really old quote from a guy called Deming, who was a management consultant in the 60s, contrasting the way the Japanese manufacturing this is, worked in contrast to the way that US manufacturing worked at the time and their approach to quality. And he said he was laughing at the American approach to quality. He said, "Let's make toast the American way. I'll burn it, you scrape it."
That's a great quote.
It's this idea that, you know, to have quality, you assume that the people that are making the toast are going to burn it, and then you pay a whole bunch of people to detect the burnt toast and then scrape the mess off, rather than that, as you know, the Japanese were doing at the time, actually ensuring that as the toast is made, quality is put into it right at that point. So you're making sure that you're actually building a quality thing right as you go. And this is the advantage of doing test-driven development. So when you work from a failing test rather than adding the test later, once the bugs have already been introduced, if you work from a failing test, it keeps you honest about where your defects are. You get to see the defects often before they've even been written. You get to think things through a bit more. And it also helps you to proceed at a more sort of honest pace. So you're finding and fixing defects in a much, much tighter loop than you are if you have to wait days for a QA person to run a test for you and then give you feedback. So you're fixing the problems while the code's still warm, you know, while you're still familiar with it.
I mean, I definitely agree. I love how you said people that are doing Scrums automatically assume they're doing Agile. And sometimes that's not always the case. And I think I've seen that personally on projects I've been on. So I guess my biggest challenge though for that is how to get developer buy-in with this. I think if you're a developer, you would love to create unit tests, you'd like to write code, but that has not been my experience. So do you have any tips on how you can get developer buy-in for this type of process? Or is it more of just let me show you the benefits that you're going to get out of it and let's roll with it?
Yeah, so this is a tricky one. I mean, sometimes developers do just genuinely believe that they don't write bugs when they write code, right? You have people who feel like that. I'm not one of them. I'm perfectly comfortable with the fact that I will write buggy code, and I would like to have habits and techniques that support me given that ugly reality. So there are odd people, odd individuals that think like that. But I think usually really the reason that teams don't try and write tests first is twofold. One is that they don't think they have time. And two is that they don't know how. So learning how is t- takes time itself, right? It's an investment. And often it may be very difficult to write tests for your application because it wasn't designed to be tested. So actually, they may be right that they don't have time because they might have to, you know, introduce major architectural shifts in order to actually facilitate automated testing or at least sort of reliable, quick, fast feedback automated testing of their app. But it's usually easier than you think once you get going and once you give it a crack. But it does sometimes need, you know, quite serious expertise to make some of these legacy systems testable. And so I think that part of it is about making sure that the environment's in place from a point of view of the architecture and the design of the system to make sure it, you know, it is actually easier to work from automated tests than to not. Partly it's about giving people time and, you know, if necessary, training to teach them the skills that they need, given that the architecture supports them, to give them the skills to work that way. And then I think the other thing is taking the pressure off them a little bit, because what we're talking about doing is we're really talking about shifting where the time gets spent in the development cycle, right? So if you measure the time it takes for an idea to come into the team and for that idea to leave the team as working defect-free software, what we ought to see, if there is any point in doing test-driven development, is that that total time will be reduced. Because overall, although the team will spend a bit more time doing a bit more analysis and a bit of writing tests before they do the development work, what I've seen time and time again when I've coached teams in this is that where their management were then expecting to have to do a long kind of QA stabilization period, once the development work's been done, there just isn't anything to do. So that time that you've invested up front pays back dividends once the development's finished, because there isn't that rework cycle that teams are so used to having to thrash around in. So it's the architecture, it's the education, and then I think it's management really having the confidence that this is the right way to go, to take the pressure off the team so that they will slow down and learn how and write those tests, and then you'll see the benefits once the code's been written and there isn't a large amount of QA work to do.
Awesome. Yeah, I definitely agree with the shifting in time almost. Rather than going from debugging and fixing code, you spend more time on the prevention, hopefully to save time later on, where it becomes more costly to actually fix these things once they get into production.
It's also more predictable, because if you've been fixing the defects as you found them and you're measuring how fast you're going, you know, you're measuring your velocity with all those good Scrum tools that you've learned about, that's it. You know, once you've done that work, there is no more to do. And these sort of stabilization phases that teams will go through when they are writing lots of defects and they're having to go around these rework loops where, you know, the QA finds a bug and then they go back and fix the bug. And then as they fix that bug, they create another one. And I've seen teams just get, you know, lost in that, thrashing around in that for weeks or even months. And that is very, very unpredictable. And that's the way that you miss deadlines and disappoint customers. Because actually, customers are more interested in predictability necessarily than they are in a quicker deadline.
Definitely. Yeah, I definitely agree. I've worked on projects where now we're releasing 3.11, 3.12 because they, we found a bug, let's fix it. Oh, we need a new release. So it's so true.
Yeah, and I mean, this isn't a magic bullet. Like, people are always going to make mistakes. This whole process involves human beings. We are fallible. But it's about coming to terms with that and doing your best to try and mitigate for it, and really waiting until a QA phase is not a good way to do that. It's a very costly, wasteful way to do it.
Absolutely. Like you said, it's not a silver bullet, but the predictability, like you said, is a huge benefit, because it's one of the hottest things for software for me is estimating. So if we can at least estimate better, it's a huge win in itself, just doing, getting that.
So, but there's another thing about you were talking about perversion. I love that, yes. That word of the sort of the intended use of cucumber. So I think the other thing that we see is where feature files are written, you know, just as tests, whether that's even before the code's written, but they're written just as tests. So like one of the things that Cucumber can be valuable for is it gives a medium for expressing tests in a kind of non-technical friendly way, which can include, you know, people who are used to doing manual QA. So it can be thought of as a way for manual QAs to get involved in doing automation. And I don't think that's entirely wrong. I think it's certainly better than having those poor people have to just keep repetitively punching buttons, working their way through a manual test script. But it just isn't the long-term solution. You know, those teams are really missing out on big, big benefits that they could be getting if they were to change the way that they approached QA and thought about QA. And the thing that we often see as well in those situations where the Cucumber tests are kind of maintained by non-developers and where really the people who are involved in writing them are testers, QAs, rather than people who think about them as specifications, so maybe business analysts or product owner, is that they're very, very hard to read. So they really don't give this benefit of a executable specification, you know. They really just read like a test script. So there's lots and lots of detail in there about how the test is being done rather than what behavior is being tested. So we'll see, you know, details about the fields on the form, that what the user's username and password and email address and birth date and address are, you know, just in order to log in. And actually what we really want is just to have a step there that says, given I am logged in, because the intent of the scenario is to describe some other behavior. And that's the other kind of the problem that we see a lot.
Absolutely. And this segues perfectly into my next question. This is one of the reasons why I love the book, the Cucumber book. I'll be honest, we actually don't use Cucumber. We use JBehave. Mm-hmm. But when I first started, I got my hands on this book, and Chapter 6 saved my life, because we started a new BDD effort that we never done before. And I think without Chapter 6, we probably would have done pretty much all the non-best practices that you list here.
Is that when cucumbers go bad?
When cucumbers go bad, I love it. Yes.
Yeah. So it's funny, that chapter, because I wrote the sort of first draft of that chapter. I did a consulting job. It's actually a friend of mine's company, and they'd been using Cucumber for a couple of years. Or was it Specflow, maybe? I think they were a .NET shop. I can't remember. But anyway, I went and visited them and spent a couple of days with them sort of reviewing where they were at and what kinds of problems they had and what suggestions I could make. And I wrote them this little paper and presented it back to them at the end of the visit. And I kept it. And then I went to visit another customer, do a similar thing. And they had exactly the same problems. And I tell you, you know, almost everybody I go and see, I guess the thing is, like, people don't get me to go and visit the places where it's all going fine, right? Because they don't want to pay me. They don't need my help. But yeah, I see these problems over and over. And it comes down to, actually, I was just speaking on Twitter the other day with Nat Price, who wrote this excellent book about test-driven development called Growing Object-Oriented Software Guided by Tests. If you're a Java programmer, I really highly recommend that book. In fact, even if you're not, if you're just into TDD and object-oriented programming, it's a really good book. And where was I going with this? Nat and I were talking about listening to the tests. So the feedback that you get from tests, it comes on so many levels. And, you know, one of those levels will be, well, they're taking a long time to run. And if they're taking a long time to run, that is feedback for you. That is information. And you need to deal with that, you know, not by just figuring out a way to parallelize the tests or running them using a headless browser. Those are really just kind of putting sticking plasters over the problem. You know, a problem like slow build is because you've got a big lump of architecture that you haven't broken up, and you need to be allocating the test to more specific areas of the architecture so they can run faster and be more focused. And yeah, flickering tests. Yeah, everybody gets these problems.
Yeah, it's kind of scary because it's actually every single problem I run into. I manage 8 Scrum teams. I'm like the automation lead, and I have to talk to them every day. And it's always, if I could just force people to read this chapter, you know, it'd be so much easier because it's just, I'm just repeating. It's like I take out the book, I have a dog-eared, and I just read it, all the highlighted things to them, and they think I'm a genius. But I'm like, just get this book, read this chapter, you'd be all set. It's crazy. And funny thing about the time is I kicked off a test today at 7:30. It's now 12:30 here, and it's 5 hours. It's still running. So this chapter itself talks about, well, this may be because I'm not doing my job then if they're running this long, but what's your favorite tip within the Cucumber book? Because not only is this chapter excellent, but you have highlighted things where you say Matt says, you have some really good tips. So is there one tip in this book that you see most people gravitating towards or finding really helpful that you recommend everyone should know?
I think the two things for me really are listening to the customers and listening to the code. You need to be able to look both ways. You need to, you know, using Gherkin as a tool to help you to collaborate with the other people on your team, to understand their point of view and get that shared understanding noted down somewhere. But really the writing of the Gherkin is a trick. And the trick is that by trying really hard to explain to a computer what you want the system to do, you have to figure out together what it is you want the system to do. And that's the trick, because it's that figuring out that's really the magic. And that's where, you know, once you've got that clear consensus between you about what you want to do, really the rest of it gets a lot easier. But then on the other side, you know, when you're doing automation and you're running tests against your system, it's listening to those tests, you know, listening to the code. If something's hard to test, if something's slow to test, if something's unreliable to test, there's probably a deeper issue there, and trying to look for, you know. So one of the things that we see sometimes is teams will do this, like they'll get kind of, in fact, I did this talk earlier in the year. What's it called? Is it called maybe Beyond BDD or Life After BDD, something like this? It was about this sort of transition that I see teams go through. And there's this period where they get kind of in love with using scenarios, and they get almost addicted to this process of like, this is just great. You know, we sit down with the BA and the QA and the dev, and we have these three amigo sessions, and we describe all the behavior we want in scenarios, and then we wire it up to Selenium, and we drive out the behavior in the app, and it's great. And, you know, we never get any bugs anymore. And our build is, you know, I remember when it used to take half an hour, now it takes 2 hours, and you just told me about yours, which, you know, it's taking 4 hours or whatever, and it just creeps up on you all the time. And this issue of too many acceptance tests, it's a really big deal. And so this sort of, this attraction to describing everything in scenarios, but then assuming that every scenario in Cucumber must be a full stack acceptance test, full stack integration test, that's really where the problem lies. Because if you're going to have so many of your tests test the entire stack of the application, you're bound to have some of them be unreliable because there's so many layers getting tested. They're bound to be slow, but usually, you know, it doesn't need to be that way. It's a crude way to test that individual bit of behavior, because actually oftentimes, you know, maybe there's two scenarios which are testing two different situations, and actually those two different situations are just the two branches of an if statement in a template which takes some JSON data and renders it as HTML. And you don't really need to fire up a web browser, fire up a web server, inject data into a SQL database, run a web request, which, you know, makes a query into the database and comes all the way back up through the layers of your stack and then into a web browser across the HTTP connection, just in order to test the two branches of the if statement in that view template. You know, there are much more efficient ways of testing that if statement. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to push the behavior specification, the scenario, somewhere where it's invisible to non-technical people. If that behavior is still really fundamental and really important to those people and you want to keep it in your living documentation, well, it's a matter of using a flavor of Cucumber which can actually reach directly into your code. So if your code's written in PHP, you can use Behat. If your code's written in C#, you can use SpecFlow. If it's written in JVM language, you can use Cucumber JVM. And there are so many different flavors of Cucumber now, which we can take a Gherkin specification and run code in all kinds of different languages. So there's no reason why necessarily a Cucumber test has to integrate the entire stack of your app. app. And that's a really good way to speed the tests up.
Yeah, that's an awesome point. I think this is commonly known as the test pyramid.
Right.
At the base, you should have all your tests as unit. Middle is integration, where you said, like rest test, if you can do it at underneath the UI and get the, if, you know, say it's a business logic on a server, there's no need to go through a UI for every single test. You can test it at the rest level and maybe have one end-to-end test that may test one, just one scenario, but the majority of them are at the lower level where it'll be more reliable, quicker,
and
faster.
Yeah, and a lot of people see that, you know, because it's a cucumber test and it's expressed from a user's point of view, that it therefore has to be wired up to hit the system through the UI. And I just don't think that's the case. Our experience of, you know, working on these larger suites, either ones that we maintain ourselves or with other people, is that it doesn't have to be the case. You know, if the concern about does this behavior belong in a test specification which is business readable is a different concern to, do I need to connect this test to the entire stack of the application in order to give me good confidence that when it passes, I can trust it? Yes, you definitely need a certain number of tests at the top of the pyramid, which test the whole stack. But if you can, you know, the lower level, the closer to the key if statements that you can connect any test, whether it's business readable or not, the more reliable and faster and actually better the feedback is going to be. Because the problem with a multi-layered test, which tests lots and lots of layers of the app and integration, is that when it fails, it's really hard to know why, right? Because it's really hard to point your finger at where the problem must be, because it's covered such a large amount of code.
You do have a chapter in the book, Testing a REST Web Service, where you actually go over some examples of what a feature file might look like for someone that needs to test a lower level type test, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'd even go lower level than that, though. I'd go directly to the domain model. If you if you notice in the worked example, when we build this really sort of trivial ATM, the first few iterations of that scenario, we're just connecting the scenario directly to a domain model. But then after, I can't remember, sort of three, four chapters, we replace or we wrap the domain model with a web interface. But the scenario does not change. And we actually end up with two different adapters that can be used between the step definitions and the system under test to drive it at those two different layers. So we can either connect it directly into the domain model to get very fast feedback and test it that way. Or if we want a slower but, you know, more thorough test run, then we can connect it to the web app on the outside as well. So I think this is the way forward, you know, really for teams that still want to use Cucumber to document behavior, but also want to have fast, reliable test suites, is to think about these, the different levels that you can connect the test to and try and connect at the lowest level possible. And of course, this really requires tight collaboration. You've got to just blur the lines completely between people that are writing the Cucumber and people that are writing the code, because it becomes a tool to help you to write the code.
And actually, I think it's chapter 8, support code, where you have a section called Making the Switch, where you go over the domain model and the user interface. It was really helpful. Yeah.
The other thing about this, so one of the things I've not mentioned yet, but this idea about, you know, communication between technical and non-technical people, is this idea from BDD, which comes from Eric Evans' book, Domain Driven Design, this idea of a common language or a ubiquitous language, where the words you use in your domain model and in your solution space, you know, so in your database columns and tables and the model classes that you have and the methods on those classes, that those names are names which you would also find if you had a conversation or read a specification document that was written by a non-technical stakeholder, by a business person. So this idea that the same words, the technical people use the same words for stuff in the solution domain as the non-technical people use in the problem domain. And if you can keep that language consistent, all kinds of communication problems don't happen. All kinds of misunderstandings don't happen. And everything gets faster and easier. And one idea that we've been starting to talk about more now in the Cucumber and BDD community is this idea of modeling by example. So really trying to kind of connect these ideas from domain-driven design with this idea of running scenarios directly against your domain model, that if you actually develop like that, you know, you can really use, you can see the step definitions mirroring the code that's inside them, because what you describe in English in a scenario then becomes what you try and do to your domain model in the step definition.
I know you also have a book, The Cucumber Recipes. I actually didn't know you were one of the authors. I pulled it on my bookshelf today and I said, oh, wait a minute. I wrote this one too.
Well, I got my name on it. Ian Dees did the majority of the work. I probably wrote three of the chapters in that, and then, you know, read and reviewed the rest and kind of helped come up with the list. But Ian did all the really, really hard work on that book. He did an amazing job. I mean, there's just some incredibly esoteric things that he managed to drive from cucumber in that book. It's amazing.
So that brings up a point. Is there anything that you think most people don't know you can do with cucumber? I guess maybe cucumber recipes has a whole list of them, but is there one that you find specifically that you find very helpful?
Right. Well, so one, which I was just using yesterday with a customer, which most people don't know about, and this is only available in the Ruby one as far as I know, is that you can ask the operator a question. So in the Ruby version of cucumber, if you have these various helper methods that are available to you within your step definitions, like, for example, pending, which is always called by default from the generated snippet of step definition, which is produced if you have an undefined step. You always see it starts out with this call to pending, so that the, you know, your copied and pasted step definition is in that pending state. I'm trying to think of any more methods, but the one I'm talking about here is this one called ask. So if you call ask within a step definition and pass that a string, then the when cucumber runs on the console, it will stop and it will print out that string, and it will wait until the person who's watching the test run types something in and presses enter. And then whatever they typed in is returned from the ask function. So this can be a way to introduce sort of semi-automation of scenarios which are maybe difficult to automate for whatever reason. So you can have given when steps which are fully automated and they are, you know, inserting data into the system and clicking through repetitive screen workflows to get to a particular stage, and then a then step which says, you know, perhaps ask the user for something that's a bit subjective or difficult to test automatically, and you can get around it that way. The other way I've seen this happen sometimes is it's used for a given step where the data setup was really complicated, you know, so it would say, ask, can you get Lee to email that bit of XML straight into the back end, or however it gets done. Yeah, so that's one, ask.
That sounds awesome. I agree. If you can automate something at least halfway, I think that's a huge benefit to that, rather than having a, you know, given and. Probably using an ask would be a better way to get around that.
Yeah, and I think also we see a lot of teams now that are sort of, they're trying to shake off Quality Center or something like that, and they'll use Gherkin to specify all of their test cases, and then just tag the ones that they haven't automated yet with manual, or tag the ones that they have automated with automated, and they'll just work their way through them gradually. So they'll chip off, you know, they'll start with 1,000 test cases, all documented, but all still being run manually, and then they'll just gradually automate them. And so if you're using tags to mark out the ones that, you know, can't be run automatically yet, you can exclude them from your CI build. But you can also have these sort of semi-manual ones, which at least they save the person doing the QA from all of the manual kludging around, and just give that test run a bit of structure.
So Matt, are there any other resources or books you would recommend someone to learn about BDD or cucumber?
Okay, yeah, good question. So a good one for non-technical folks, especially people that are sort of curious about, so, you know, if you want to try and help convince your manager this is a good way to go, is Specification by Example. That's by Gojko Adzic. It's a few years old now, but it's really full of real world case studies. So Goyko went around and interviewed a whole bunch of companies and teams that were using BDD and tells their stories in that book. So you can hear a lot about, you know, how it's worked for different teams, how they made it work. So that's a really good book. Liz Keogh, who's one of the original sort of creators of BDD and is particularly interested in the sort of customer facing side of BDD, you know, this specification or exploration by example technique. And she's written a book, or she's in the process of writing a book, which is available on LeanPub. And I think it's just called Behavior Driven Development. There's also a book called BDD in Action.
Oh, by John Smart?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a great book.
Yeah. Oh, good. Okay. That's good. That's a great recommendation. Yeah. So I've heard really good things about it too.
Excellent. Okay, Matt, before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their BDD Cucumber efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
You can contact me, Matt Wynn, on Twitter, or you can email me, Matt, M-A-T-T, at cucumber.pro. And we do worldwide training and consulting to help teams get better with Cucumber. We've now started a business. So Aslak Julian, who's the maintainer of Cucumber JS, Aslak's the original creator of Cucumber, and he still maintains the JVM one. The three of us have created a company last year to try and create a sort of sustainable ecosystem around Cucumber. Cool. So, you know, using there are hundreds of thousands of users of Cucumber around the world, thousands of companies that are using it. And a lot of those companies would like to be able to pay for, you know, training and advice and support. So that's great for us because that means that we can actually make this our livelihood now, and it pays for us to then spend time improving the open source. So it's a sort of win-win situation. So yeah, nice. Please get in touch if you think I can help. We've also got some online training videos now as well. Cucumber School, which I've actually been working on today, the latest episode of that. So if you if you can't persuade your boss to get us to come in and meet you in person, then that might be a more cost-effective way of still getting our advice, the Cucumber School videos. Piece of actionable advice. If you're a business analyst, find a QA and a developer. If you're a QA, find a developer and a business analyst. If you're a developer, find a QA and a business analyst. And take one of the stories for your next sprint and sit down and spend 20 minutes, just 20 minutes, before anybody writes any code, just discussing that story. And try to make a list of the business rules that you understand for that story, and try to make a list of examples that illustrate those business rules, and try and get some agreement about what those examples would be. Just spend 20 minutes on one story for your next sprint. And mark my words, you'll find that story is easier to develop than any of the other ones.
Thanks, Matt, for sharing your BDD Cucumber automation awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to testtalks.com/35. And while you're there, make sure to check out our sponsor, Sauce Labs. Click on the more info link underneath our exclusive sponsor section to learn about all the benefits of using Sauce Labs. And that's it for this episode of Test Talks. If you enjoyed this episode, head on over to testtalks.com and click on the subscribe to iTunes button. While you're there, leave hopefully a 5-star review, and I'll give you a shout out in an upcoming episode. And as always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.